You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa. Ko Mary Margaret Slack tōku, ingoa no mai haere mai ki te wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora, welcome to the Thursday Wire again. Me and Rachel are back again. And you're sitting quite far away from me,
social distancing.
We've got some smiley faces on the hand sanitizer bottle in front of us.
Yes, we've got hand sanitizer everywhere.
Mm-hmm. It smells quite good too.
Yeah.
Like, I've always been a hand washing as opposed to hand sanitizer girl because I don't like the smell of the alcohol in my hands. But
I've just been carrying around my Dettol as like a crutch recently.
You went around with a face mask yesterday?
Yeah, I had a face mask, but now I've switched to like a silk scarf. Like, COVID-19 is truly great for girls. We get to be like extra like attention seeking and take like mask selfies.
I haven't got a mask yet, so I haven't taken a mask selfie yet. But best believe it will be my Twitter DP if I get
one. Anything we can do during these dire times, I guess.
Yeah, like deliver really good news on Te Wire. I'm your host, Mary Margaret. That's Rachel.
Hi.
We're going to be with you for another hour. Reporting on the news. We've got a weekly catch up with Radio Adelaide Zoe Canatis, and we're learning about how it feels to be on the ground in Australia where COVID is present but there's been little government response. We also catch up with Labour's Andrew Little once again and recap the legalisation of abortion that passed last night, and we're also having a conversation about his government's COVID package announcement this week. Rachel reports on the first case of human trafficking and slavery to reach conviction in New Zealand. So,
yep, that's me.
Yeah, serious story. I'm interested to learn about it because I feel like a lot of like jargon and legal precedent that I don't understand yet.
Yeah, even me. But I tried to go into the legal side of it and the judgment and things. But also it's quite an interesting case because it's, you know, this stuff happens, like exploitation of migrants, and this is just the first time someone got caught. So
right.
I tried to delve into that side of it.
Are you going to take it to all your law lecturers and be like, please, can I have my degree early?
I hope they give me an A because of coronavirus. I'm not in no position to study law right now.
Nirvana is also bringing us her interview with choreographer Amber Liberté, whose basement show about climate change was about to begin but has been postponed or called off and will now be adapted into a film because of coronavirus, which we found out this morning. But nevertheless, we're listening to that interview because it's really interesting. Tukupatu he mai, text us on 5395 or why mai, give us a call on 309-3879. Please do so today because we're dealing with community-centred topics and it is important that we chat to each other and look after each other as much as we can at the moment. The lines are open and I'm here if you're looking for a friendly stranger. Let's get into it.
You call that a news update? This is a news update. It's Neighbourhood Watch.
Up first is our catch-up with Zoe Canatis, who shared with me this week quite an honest portrayal of what it feels like to be in Australia amid the COVID outbreak. Okay, so last week when you and I spoke, the Australian government was set to deliver a stimulus package that was centred around the impact of coronavirus on the country's outputs. So what's happened since then? Has there been a more sort of human-based approach?
Somewhat. So obviously, since we spoke last, it feels like the world's completely changed and the government have obviously somewhat changed their approach to this whole pandemic. Yesterday, Scott Morrison calling on the country not to travel, to stay 1.5 metres away from each other and stay in quarantine if you've come home from Australia. From overseas. A human-based approach, I felt the conference yesterday was talking a lot about the economy and how we're going to come out through this on the other side and be strong and have a strong economy, this, that, the other. So it's hard to say if it was, you know, a sort of human approach. A lot of criticism that we're putting economy over health at this point.
Okay.
For example, numbers are rapidly growing in the country. As of yesterday, I think in New South Wales, there was another 60 cases just from yesterday. So the number of people with coronavirus are growing quite quite rapidly, and there is lots of criticism in terms of no schools are being shut. It's still almost business as usual, but it's not. And many people, for example, for a personal note, I work in the travel industry when I'm not at radio.
Right.
And I'm about to go to work in 2 hours, and I do not know if I'm going to continue to have a job in 2 hours' time.
Right.
So this is happening so quickly, obviously. People in hospitality or casual workers, everything is so uncertain. People are genuinely losing their jobs left, right, and center, or just being put on hold. I don't know, you know, having their job sort of no hours for at least the foreseeable future. So it feels scary, and I'm scared.
Yeah. I mean, it's like you say, there's really, like, no one can know what to expect, but New Zealand has, since Sunday, started, like, really enforcing more serious policy, and your guys' rates are higher, and I
have heard the term herd immunity being thrown around, but cases are running quite rapidly because a lot of people are coming, you know, back home to Australia with this past few days. You know, working in the travel industry, I do know, like, a lot of clients are abandoning their trips and then coming back immediately, like, as soon as they can. So there is an influx of people coming home. I've heard reports of people breaking quarantine, actually, in my job. There's a little, like, insight for you. People have literally been breaking quarantine in order to come into my workplace. So, you know, I think that's attributed to the spread quite a bit. And I don't know, I was walking through the streets of Adelaide a couple of nights ago, and the St. Paddy's Day, and the pub near Radio Adelaide was packed. Like, I wasn't out and about near Radio Adelaide coming to and fro. And pubs are packed, restaurants are packed. So, it just feels weird. People maybe aren't as aware, but I'm not sure.
Which surely stems from the fact that your government hasn't, like, made any proper announcements or decisions about it yet.
Exactly. So only of yesterday did we see this ban of 100 people, no gatherings of 100 people inside any restaurants, cinemas, non-essentials. Outside areas are up to 500 people gatherings. There's been no really harsh action from the government. And there has been action, but I'm not sure if it's going to be enough.
Right.
Looking forward, I'm obviously not an expert on these things. I'm obviously just panicking. I'm not being very unbiased at the moment in terms of news reporting. I am freaking out a little bit in terms of my job, especially. It's the future feels unclear.
Yeah.
But I feel like I have a lot of, I'm sharing a lot of sentiment with many, many other people, Australians, you know, part-time and casual workers. We're all feeling this kind of dread at the moment of uncertainty.
And what are your reckons? Do you think that that's going to compel ScoMo to actually, like, have any form of lockdown? What do you think could happen by the end of the week?
We don't know. I hope that there is so much community outcry about this issue that I really do hope it changes the government's mind. Even things as the increased amount of people that will be applying for welfare soon. That surely, the numbers there don't lie. So hopefully, we see some sort of change, some sort of lockdown. At the moment, the government is saying that it's more of a six-month process. These are the kind of words and phrases that are coming out of Scott Morrison's mouth. This will be 6 months. And, you know, that creates so much panic in the community, thinking that this issue could be going on for 6 months, or this uncertainty could be going on for 6 months. It does create a lot of panic. As you would all know, in New Zealand and anywhere in the world, you know, shelves on supermarkets are completely empty.
Yeah.
People are panicking. People don't know what to do. So it's strange, and I do really hope that, I mean, the proof is already there, so I don't know why the government and Scott Morrison aren't taking further action. But who knows if by the end of the week, it could totally be different, because this time last week, I would not have thought I'd be having this conversation with you.
So, yeah.
Things have been changing so rapidly, as you would all know as well.
So how, apart from, obviously you said that there were people in the bars on St. Paddy's, apart from people avoiding or ignoring health experts' advice, is it quieter or busier at the moment in Adelaide?
It's quieter.
Yeah.
I was walking through one of our main malls, Rundle Mall, to get home, actually, the other day after breakfast. So I'm still coming in and out for radio and for work, just these places haven't been shut down. But lots of procedures are being taken here at Radio Adelaide. We're definitely limiting foot traffic. Anyway, but definitely quieter. Walking through Rundle Mall about 9 a.m., one of the busiest times people going to and fro, but lots of businesses have taken the initiative for people to work from home. I do really feel for lots of retail workers that are still having to go to work.
Yep.
And, you know, I hope people do realise that they don't have to go and buy their peppermint tea from, like, T2, or they can just stay home and not have to interact with retail workers, because it would be a really scary time for them as well.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
How common is self-isolation as, like, a voluntary thing in Adelaide at the moment?
Well, the quietness does indicate this. Both my housemates are working from home, from their businesses, their jobs. I had from Monday Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday off. I haven't been going out and about. I've just stayed inside my house. It seems to be pretty common. Self-isolation, self-distancing seems to be pretty understood. Despite not being completely encouraged by our government, people are still taking it on board to do it themselves.
That was Neighbourhood Watch. Ripper.
That was Zoe Kanadis. Tuku Patuhi Mai, text me on 5395 about your thoughts on the differences between Australia's and New Zealand's government's response to COVID. Whakaronga tonu mai. We'll be back with a discussion of similar topics with Andrew Little after this. Here's the A-Track remix of the Yeah Yeah Yeahs, Heads Will Roll.
and I'm here to say, looking for a flatmate in the linen that's grey. You gotta be cool and you gotta be tough. You gotta be vegan and no pets or smokers.
Room in Freeman's Bay Cottage. Me, urban sophisticated wine expert, French cinema aficionado. You, educated, tidy, silent.
Room in flat, Mount Eden. Text Dave.
Whoever or wherever you're after, the 95BFM Accommodation Guide is here for you. Email your listing to accommodationguide@95bfm.com. The 95BFM Accommodation Guide, every Thursday on drive and online at 95bfm.com.
Now it's time for our weekly chat with Labour MP Andrew Little.
Welcome back to The Wire. We're now moving to another weekly catch-up with Labour's Andrew Little, who I was very excited to speak to this morning after last night's removal of abortion from the Crimes Act.
It's good to have achieved that.
It is.
Yeah, for sure.
We'll mostly be talking about COVID, but I would like to sort of just recap how it all happened last night. Yeah. I know that there was some negative comments made by Greg O'Connor, for example. So what did it look like last night? Was it a close margin?
Yeah, it was close. I sort of picked that as we went through the different stages of the House, the votes were falling on our side in terms of support for it, and particularly through the committee stage, which was the really intense stage last weekend, Tuesday and Wednesday morning of this week. You could tell that the votes were under pressure, and I think that was a product of the scare campaign that was being run by the anti-abortionists.
Okay, let's move to the fact that the coalition government has announced a stimulus package this week. Globally, coronavirus has highlighted ways in which many wages and employment rights fall short of providing people with adequate safety nets. And Minister Robertson's package announcement shows that your party does acknowledge that this is true for New Zealand. But I wonder, what about after COVID-19? Do you think this will change how Labour drafts policy and treats those who are not wealthy?
You know, I think it's an event like this that's going to cause everybody to rethink just how we approach a whole heap of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in business and when it comes to structure of work, the way people work and incomes, we're going to rethink this because this is a shock to the world economy, to ours as well, and we've fallen back on what we know. So people lose jobs, we provide top-up payments and income support and all the rest of it, but you know, you've got to say, in this day and age, the chance of this happening again is probably, you know, not remote.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, it's really challenged the way we live in our communities as well. We're used to sort of close contact, a lot of things happening, mass this, mass that. And that has its own risks. So I think in the years to follow, there will be a lot of rethinking about how we even live our lives and structure ourselves.
Right. Now, recently, Statistics New Zealand released data that showed there was no significant change in child poverty since 2017. And Jackie Clark of the Aunties told me at the time that failure to significantly increase benefits is a big reason for that. I wonder why it took a pandemic for this government to significantly increase benefits and subsidies.
Yeah, I think it's slightly unfair. I think we had the Welfare Expert Advisory Group doing their work. They did their report. We got that last year. And work has been going on about how we start to address the recommendations that they made, including lifting benefit levels. Because, you do things from one budget to the next, the budget that's announced in May, the work for that starts in December of the year before, so there's a long lag time. So we get a report in the middle of last year. We're not going to start the work in terms of getting anything up for the budget until the end of the year, ready for something this year. So that work was underway, but in any event, we could see that not only was a large number more people going to go on the benefit, but benefit levels have been inadequate, and we know that those on a benefit tend to spend what they've got. That's a great means of economic stimulus for the recovery, and it made sense to introduce an increase in benefit levels sooner rather than later.
Some renters have reported no compassion from their landlords and payment deadlines during the outbreak of COVID. The package didn't have any mention of a moratorium on rent. Do you think that's something that you'll consider? Is that something on the books at all or of a concern?
We don't. There's no power that we've got in any act anywhere that allows us to impose a rent freeze or a moratorium. So we don't have that up our sleeves to use. Obviously, we were conscious that if we do things like increase benefit levels, provide wage subsidies, there's always the possibility that some landlords will see an opportunity and hike rents and, you know, they get the benefit of it. We haven't seen that happening so far. I think if we did see that happening, then that would be enough to prompt us to do something a little more severe to give ourselves the power to make sure that, you know, landlords aren't just being opportunistic.
Right.
But we're not at that point yet, and there's a lot of seeing what works over the next few months, I think, in relation to a lot of the measures that we're taking.
Mm. How is COVID-19 affecting prisoners? They're sort of isolated anyway, but is there any new kind of social distancing rules taking place in prisons at the moment?
Yeah, I think that, our prisons tend to have reasonably large numbers, and there are activities that happen together, like their meals and things like that. So I think what we'll start to see is the prisons staggering meal times for different groups of prisoners so they can have more distance between them. I think there will be issues with visiting. You know, you want to maintain family visits and visits from people from outside, but I think, you know, precautions will be taken to make sure that that people are safe. And then, obviously, you know, prisoners have got to be able to have access to their lawyers and legal advice, but I think we may well see some precautions being taken to make sure that the visits go ahead, but the risk of transmission is minimised.
Moving on, I read a report that the re-entry cost for Pike River has increased again. Mm. I thought I'd check in light of the stimulus package. On Tuesday, you did say that you remain committed to the recovery and forensic examination of the Pike River mine. Will that change?
No, we made that decision knowing that we're putting the stimulus package together, and actually the extra money for Pike, it's roughly nearly $11 million plus a nearly $5 million contingency. I mean, that appears insignificant compared to the package for COVID. But the reality is, you know, there's 25 odd jobs on the West Coast that the Pike River Recovery Agency supports. If we just said, well, that's it, we've exhausted the budget, we're stopping now, and we haven't completed the project, we not only haven't fulfilled that commitment to the families, but then you're putting a whole bunch of people in a very tight job market in one place in New Zealand. So I think, I think it is the right thing to do, to see the project through. Yeah. We have been very clear with the families. Once we exhaust this and we get to the end of the drift and we've completed that stuff, that's it. We won't be going to the mine workings. The project is more expensive than I would have liked, but we also knew that there was a bit of a touch and feel sort of aspect to this, and find out as we go. And we have done. There were things that we didn't anticipate that have cost more than we thought.
Right. Just to finish, I saw last night that after the abortion vote went through, you were still in the House for the Electoral Registration of Sentenced Prisoners Bill?
That's right, yeah.
What's that bill?
So this reinstates prisoner voting for prisoners sentenced to a prison sentence of 3 years or less. It basically takes us back to the status quo it was in 2010 when the then national government changed the law to not only prevent all prisoners from voting, but actually take them off the roll. And what we've seen, what the Waitangi Tribunal found when they looked at it last year, is that what that effectively means is that those prisoners never get back on the roll.
Yeah.
And it has a disproportionate impact on Māori. It's a voter suppression thing, and it's insidious, it's unnecessary. We've proceeded on the principle that if at the time of election you're on a sentence of less than 3 years, you're going to be out before the next election. You ought to have a right to have a say on who's leading the country that you're going to be released into. So that's why all parties in government have agreed to reinstate things as they were in 2000.
That was Labour MP Andrew Little.
The Wire.
That was Labour's Andrew Little. Heaha o whakaaro, what are your thoughts on this government stimulus package and how it compares to fiscal policy over the last part of this government's term? 5395 is the number to text, or why am I, give me a call on 309 3879.
Kei te whakarongo koe ki te Wire, marunga irirangi pō.
The Wire.
Rachel's come back into the studio.
Hi, Mary Margaret.
How are you?
I'm good.
Do you have an introduction for your story? Or are we jumping straight in?
Just jump straight in. It speaks for itself.
Okay, excellent. So this is Rachel's story on the first conviction of human trafficking and slavery in New Zealand. Let's get into it.
On Monday, the New Zealand courts observed the first conviction in New Zealand for both human trafficking and slavery. A Samoan national and New Zealand resident living in Hastings has been found guilty of 10 counts of slavery and 11 counts of trafficking at the High Court in Napier. Samoan nationals, the youngest of whom was 12, were promised paid horticultural work or schooling in New Zealand. But upon arrival, the guilty party required them to work long hours, often 7 days a week, without pay, with physical assault allegedly used to keep them in line. This was a systemic pattern of behaviour, with the offending spanning from 1994 to April 2019, discovered after 2 years of investigating from Immigration New Zealand and the New Zealand Police. In the modern age, slaves and trafficked peoples are no longer labelled and owned in the traditional sense, but rather hidden in the corners of society. Fraudulent work schemes are increasingly being recognised as slavery in the legal sense, but with the testimony of the victims being essential to getting the case over the line, cases are held back. The bureaucratic process of giving a testimony is not only traumatising, it could result in the victim getting deported. Although the trafficking of migrant workers has been happening in covert ways since the 80s, with the introduction of foreign charter vessels, in 2016 New Zealand had its first ever guilty verdict for human trafficking. Fijian nationals paid thousands of dollars for a live and work scheme, but were in fact were paid little to nothing, put on visitors' visas, and had to reside in shared rooms with no mattresses or blankets. With the shame of having borrowed money from their families and communities, and the fear of deportation, it becomes impossible to speak out. In his 2016 research paper on migrant exploitation, academic Glenn Simmons estimates that 10,000 people in New Zealand are trapped in modern-day slavery. Migrant workers in New Zealand are already vulnerable. As Anu Kaloti told 95BFM, even when the individual has worked for years to satisfy the requirements to obtain a visa, frequent law changes push legal status further out of reach. Therefore, their situation gets even more desperate, and suddenly the vague promise of horticultural work in New Zealand and putting a respected chief from one's own country in charge of sorting out their passport seems like a preferable option. Once they arrive, however, they are put up in substandard housing, made to work long hours with no pay, and are unable to approach the authorities without risking deportation. Crown Prosecutor for Monday's case, Clayton Walker, explains the situation.
If they breached any of his rules, or if they did not carry out their work or their chores to the standards required by Mr. Matamata, then they would be punished.
Reaching out to family or friends is also an uncomfortable proposition, due to the significant amount of stigma in admitting failure. But the victims still have freedom of movement. They live their day-to-day lives amongst us. During his trial, the accused pointed to this as evidence in his defence.
There's no rule. That's their own way of talking. Rules. I got no rules in my house. Everybody's same. Everybody's do what they want to do. Go out, go to the shop, anywhere. I don't stop them.
However, Justice Cull set down a precedent in the High Court on Monday when summing up the case. Despite the supposed freedom the victims had, the power dynamics were skewed, so the fraudulent employer had ultimate control and speaking out was never an option. She explained to the jurors that the slavery charges rested on whether the accused used each of the complainants as his property. In her words, ownership implies a background relationship of control, so the link between ownership and slavery is control. When slavery is concerned, this control is tantamount. This prosecution may encourage other victims to come forward, to call for justice against those who have perpetrated gross exploitation and abuse against them. Of course, it may not be possible to prosecute ourselves out of this problem, but hopefully this prosecution gets the ball rolling on victim support, and greater knowledge of trafficking and slavery issues will arise in government agencies. As work dries up under COVID-19, desperation among workers is growing. In such circumstances, working conditions can slowly deteriorate at the hands of unethical employers. Now more than ever, it is important to condemn rigged schemes for what they are.
Kei te whakarongo koe ki te Wire, marunga irirangi pō.
The Wire.
That was Rachel reporting on the first case of human trafficking and slavery in New Zealand to be convicted. We'll be back after a break. In the meantime, this is Uckers by Shy Girl. Shout out to Fraser for showing me this. It's been my track of the week. Sorry that I played it before you could, Mitchell, but I did find the song first.
Niggas. Did I forget to mention that I'm coming for you, niggas? No place to run, but you weren't you for that. There's sweet bitches in the back, in the front. Even when you're fast asleep, I'd be running on your mind. But to me, you're just a beat.
I don't give a fuck about you, niggas. But I really keep on fucking till I fuck all of you, niggas. I don't give a fuck about you, niggas. But I really keep on fucking till I fuck all of you, niggas.
I forget to say that you don't get to fuck for free. You can fuck with other bitches, but you still run back to me. I got the soul destroying pussy. I'm collecting triple D. I want your mind. Plaything, I don't mind if you're shy, but these niggas, they be craving.
I'ma have to try now.
Let me explain real quick. It's a no face, but I finna catch a case. The fuck is that? Did I start? I guess I used to dealing with a real nigga. You're about to slang it down. Tell me now, you don't wanna tell me how.
I don't give a fuck about you, no. But I really keep on fucking till I back all of you, no. I don't give a fuck about you, no. But I really keep on fucking till I back all of you, niggas.
I forget to say that you don't get to fuck for free. You can fuck with other bitches, but you still run back.
Sorry, no goths.
Excuse me?
Yeah, piss off. Maybe without those sunnies you could read the bloody sign.
No goths? This is cruel and unusual.
Not as cruel and unusual as that beautiful velvet cape. Now get out of my sight, Nosferatu.
I'm a human being.
It's hard out there for a goth, but everyone's welcome on Penny's 1-4. A heady mix of the sounds of now and the shimmering hits from our alternative past. With Penny, every Monday only on 95BFM.
Kei te whakarongo koe ki te Wire, marunga irirangi pō.
The Wire.
Amber Liberté is a theatre maker and choreographer. Her multimedia show called Our Modern Earth is a Fucking Mess was going to be on at the Basement, but has had to be cancelled in light of the pandemic, which we found out this morning. It is going to be adapted into a film, though. So we are going ahead with this interview that Nirvana had with Amber. She told Nirvana about how the story indulges in the discourse of climate change by approaching storytelling differently. The show was going to be using recycled and secondhand materials for artwork, installation, and also dance. Let's find out more.
Could you introduce yourself for the listeners?
Yeah, sure. So my name's Amber. I am a theatre maker and choreographer based in Auckland and have a show which is coming up at Basement Theatre called Our Modern Earth is a Bleep Mess.
Could you tell us more about the play?
Sure. So it's not strictly a play. It's a choreographed and devised work. And it has multimedia aspects. So there's visuals that have been put together by myself, and there's a soundtrack where we've had a bunch of artists from all over the world who have given permission to use their track, and there's going to be a group of 9 dancers, movers, actors on stage performing different choreographed pieces. And then at the same time, we have a really big element of set design by Talia Pua, And basically the piece is a live installation while there's dance work happening, and we're looking at different materials over the eras, so starting from quite natural organic materials, and then later on we'll be using plastic materials in the installations that we're doing. So the space is eventually going to get really filled with lots of different materials, but it'll be very visually pleasing, I think.
It's interesting how you speak about the different materials that you're going to be using with dance performances. And how do you think the dance performance and the props are going to enhance the themes?
Yeah, so the prop idea was based originally off the idea of looking at different borders of the world over time. So we began looking at 3000 BC up until today, and we've put kind of key pointers or key eras that we've based the set and props on.
Another question about that. Mm-hmm. Why would you like to start off right from the beginning?
Well, I was looking, like, from the very beginning, I was looking at how humans used to function pre-capitalism, kind of when the early stages of the agricultural revolution. And then I wanted to look at key eras when new materials were being introduced, and also parallel to that, looking at like how borders have changed, and in more recent years they've become a lot more aggressively changing, I think because of probably partially capitalism and the idea of ownership and I guess colonialism in the past few hundred years as well. And then in response to the dance element, that more looking at the human's journey through the ages, and that's a bit more of a like abstract element, which I think is just a nice performative aspect. So it will be visually engaging as well as watching a space transform over time.
And from my understanding, you intend to do that by displaying how climate has changed or developed throughout the ages as well, and how the props are going to change as well, right? Because in the beginning, they're just organic materials turned to plastic materials. And how do you bridge the gap between the transformations?
Yeah, well, I guess because we're looking at different eras, part of the research we've done, including, well, me, the cast, and Talia, have been looking at how the materials have changed. So, like, 3000 BC, it was very plant-based materials. Then, like, 1500 AD, we move into more, like, printed materials and papers. And then we move again into 1900 AD, which is, like, aluminium, the Industrial Revolution. So materials became more manufactured and factories were more prominent. And then we move into the 1950s, and forwards from there we go every 10 years, because that's when production started getting quite massive, especially for plastics. So especially from the 80s onwards, plastic became quite a massive thing that we used in everyday life. And up until, well, even today, like, soft plastics are still being used. So we're really interested in how that transformation has taken place in such a short amount of time and how quickly that impacted the climate.
And in terms of talking about how the impact has happened in terms of climate change, and would you rather speak a little about the nature of the play itself? Because it's, from whatever you're saying, it's not exactly a conventional way of putting up a piece of theatre or dance. It's quite experimental in itself. Would you expand on how experimental it is, and what are the elements from theatre and dance make it experimental?
Yeah, so for me as a maker in general, I like to be more experimental. I think with dance, you can take that opportunity, and I guess I'm interested because the abstract still offers some kind of meaning to people. Like, as an audience member, when you go to watch a show, regardless of whether there's a narrative or not, you're still going to project a meaning onto it. And the context for this show is so strong that the meanings are coming forward as we're making, and I think audience will still get the meanings that we're trying to communicate. I also think sometimes when shows are narrative or like too predictable, they can become moralistic. And one thing I like to avoid in work is making a work that's too moralistic. So because the piece is quite political, we don't want to moralise with the audience of what to do. We just want to pose questions and then leave that for discussion for people to talk about amongst themselves.
Drawing back upon that a little, could you expand on why it brings politics to the stage? I mean, it is a quite touchy topic at the moment, given the situation of the entire world. Could you just go in depth about the politics that you hold on the stage for this?
Yeah, well, for me, climate change is a political issue because we've had systems that have always been about convenience and what is the most economically sustainable, but unfortunately that missed the need for sustainability for environment. And now we're in this situation where our planet is like basically totally screwed. And if we don't do something about it soon, in fact, like now, if governments don't start putting policies forward that are really almost revolutionary in a way, then it's just going to keep getting worse and worse. And I think as well, governments are focused more on economic sustainability as opposed to environmental and social sustainability. So it's about making profit as opposed to looking after the land and the people.
Yeah, no, definitely. That's for sure. What are the other elements you use to make like a proper statement about climate change in terms of like props and dance performances? What is another thing that you, on top of your mind, think of when you think about communicating the severity of climate change?
Mm-hmm. Well, one of them is using video content. So we've had permissions to use video content from things like NASA, which NASA have a lot of footage of climate stuff just because that's part of their focus, and so we'll be projecting that in the space while there's dance happening and while there's live art happening. And I think that's quite informative because it shows the transformation of a planet or of an area on the planet or of an environment on the planet, and it's just a nice layer to all the different subtextual layers that we're using.
What are your last thoughts about the production in general?
Yeah, well, I mean, given the recent events, it's quite an interesting one. We are discussing with Basement what's happening. It's been a really fun production. The team, like everyone involved, is really passionate and really hardworking and have just dedicated a lot of time and commitment to this project, I think because of the nature of it.
Definitely.
We also have a slightly wider campaign where one of the producers / marketing person, Bridget Peach, is putting together a raffle, and people will be able to like buy a raffle ticket for like $2 or something, and the money that we make from that will be going towards Generation Zero, which is a organisation that are committed to fighting, or not fighting, but like trying to help shift the political stance and what can happen in terms of climate change. So for me, that's a really cool aspect of the work, that it's not just an art piece, but it's an activist piece as well.
That is beautiful.
Those
are all the questions I had. Thank you so much for chatting with me, Amber.
That's no worries.
The Wire.
I don't know. And frankly, the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire.
Thank you, Nirvana, for that story. Obviously, a bit of a shame that that's not going to go ahead given COVID, but that will be developed into a film, and we'll definitely keep you updated on that. Just to let you know, there is a live stream at the moment. Just Prime Minister Ardern is giving updates on New Zealand's relation to the COVID-19 pandemic. She has affirmed that non-essential travel should not be going ahead. The confirmed number of cases has increased by 8 from 8 to 20 since yesterday, and we can expect some greater restrictions on gatherings to be announced shortly, but I believe that she has dismissed speculation of shutdown. That live stream is accessible on RNZ if you'd like to go and check that out right now.
That was The Wire.
That was The Wire for another Thursday. Thank you to my producer, Rachel. Thank you to Nirvana for coming in with a very interesting story too. And thank you always to my news director, Lillian. Thank you to you for tuning in. Thank you to Zoe Canadas, Andrew Little and Amber Liberté for all of their contributions today and for your texts and listening at home. Make sure that you're not shaking hands. keep the elbow touches and hands on your hearts. Keep your social distance, wash your hands, cough into your elbow. Be safe, be kind. And all things going well, I'll talk to you again next week. Ka kite anō.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.